Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Trippy Politics Protest and
Potpourri.
How you doing today? So, we'll just jump right into it.
I guess we've got an interesting topic to start off with. We're going to talk about the Enbridge pipeline that burst into a fireball on August 1st, which, as of its recording, was yesterday. So, wow.
So, yeah, I didn't know much about Enbridge before even you brought up this topic to me. All I really heard was about, like, the explosion over there in, I think it was Kentucky.
Yeah, this particular explosion was in Kentucky, and it's not their first explosion on one of their pipelines this year. They had another explosion in Ohio back in January, I believe.
See,
and that injured several people.
I say I never heard about that one. I just happened to have caught that one last night on the news. You know?
There's been multiple protests against this particular pipeline as well, which is why I kind of was itching to bring this to your attention. Because this is a company that has had some of the infamous valve turners. One of those infamous valve turners was out of Seattle. I believe KBU even spoke with him in the last few months, Ken Ward. There's actually another article I pulled up about an incident of some protesters against an Enbridge pipeline that happened in February. An article from the Star Tribune mentions four protesters that were in custody in Itasca County, which is in Minnesota.
Okay.
And it was for tampering with equipment on the oil pipeline corridor in that area, and there were four different people in that incident, and they call themselves the Four Necessity Valve Turners. They've got a Facebook page. They took video of themselves doing that, and just like the Seattle activists in 2016, Ken Ward, they reached out to Enbridge beforehand and offered them the opportunity to turn off these lines themselves because of the harm that these pipelines, whether it's got crude oil, tar sands oil, or liquid natural gas, pardon me, the LNG, as it's often called, any of these are dangerous to the environment. They are dangerous to the people in the communities that they're passing through. There's been a lot of safety issues that people are concerned about, especially because of incidents like the explosion yesterday, August 1st, in Kentucky, and the explosion that happened in Ohio in January. It kind of boggles my mind that the people living and impacted by these pipelines are taking such a stand and are not being listened to. That we've actually been seeing this being going on for years.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of the Dakota Access Pipeline. I remember that one pretty well, but you know, I cover a lot different subject matter than this.
Right, you do protests, but you do
and homelessness.
Right, a little bit more different, and you've been getting a lot of things here in the city with a lot more governmental and social justice.
And like the Superfund site here in town, I've studied that a little bit, but I haven't really been paying attention too much to the
pipelines are more of a national issue. We do have an issue surrounding natural gas here in Portland, and that has to do with the Pembina-owned LNG terminal.
Oh,
in Coos Bay.
Okay.
And so KBU, especially me reporting with KBU, because I do some reporting for the PM News, we've spoken to people that are concerned about that. I mean, we've got big groups that are organizing against these kinds of companies because of the harm that it can cause. These pipelines cross waterways. They are destroying native sites. They are destroying, you know, the environment. Species are being wiped out, irreparably damaged.
And this is natural gas, like I was saying. The Dakota Access, that's
the
oil.
Dakota Access is oil.
So, I mean,
but there are
still
different types of oil. Enbridge operates all of these kinds of products. So they're an environmental concern, pardon me, environmental concern all the way across the board, as far as people living in these affected areas. Kentucky's explosion was natural gas.
Okay.
Because crude doesn't explode like that.
And where was it located?
Gosh. On the top of my head, I do forget the name of
the city. But I mean,
in Kentucky. I want to say it was near Lexington.
Okay.
Without looking that up. But it was...
And I kind of remember you saying something earlier.
It took a large area. And yeah, when you and I were talking about this earlier, I mentioned telling you about having seen a video clip.
Yeah.
One of the news video clips. They drove through the area, and they also had helicopters, you know, for an aerial shot. The whole area was black. Everything. All the soil, everything was completely black. All the houses, anything that was left, and it looked like the aftermath of an explosion.
And I seem to remember some little tidbit about it being a trailer park or something that was mainly hit, or...
Right. It was basically a community that is normally affected by things like this because they don't have the income, the economic advantage to stand up against these multinational corporations like Enbridge. So yes, this Kentucky explosion happened in a mobile home park.
Okay.
Right? So these are homes that people have often paid for. And what they do is they own the home, but they rent the space.
Base, yeah.
And once these types of homes are put on a foundation or set in one of these parks, they are incredibly expensive to move. I mean, I'm talking like tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, it's really not going to be cheap.
I haven't shared this much, but I used to live in a trailer park, so yeah.
I've known people living in a variety of situations, and mobile home parks is one of them. And when you own your home, but you can't move that home, that means that you can't move that home.
Yeah.
So when people say, well, you have to move your property off my property, maybe someone's getting rid of a mobile home park because they want to put in a pipeline, which has happened to people, you know, in places across the nation. Those people don't often get say. They lose by something called eminent domain. Well, these people, they didn't lose their property because the pipeline was there, but they did lose their property because the pipeline was there. The irony of that, like, the risk of what these types of pipelines are having to societies is increasing. The infrastructure of all these pipelines, whether it's LNG or a type of oil, they are not been updated much. There were actually in Michigan, I believe it was, Enbridge's Line 3 has had a lot of protest against it.
Okay.
On getting, refurbished, revamped. Every company wants to use a different word. Every group wants to use a different word. So they want to rework the pipeline. And on the company side, they're saying we're going to make improvements. We're going to upgrade it, which makes sense. I'm all for it. If we're going to have whatever amount of them, I definitely want them to be upgraded in modern tech. However, I think the concern is that there would be other extensions, other uses for it, that it's still going to be a safety concern in the future, and that even the upgrades aren't really going to be at the best standard.
It's not going to be sufficient enough.
They're not safe enough.
Yeah.
Right. And so even these companies keep saying we're safe. We monitor what's going on. We pay attention. We care. And we don't want to harm you.
But then
they explode or they spill.
I even know locally there was that one protest against the tar sands or something down here in Linton area on the way to over by St. John's on the way to Subbies Island. There was a huge protest of they were trying to double up the amount of oil trains coming in over there.
Are you talking about the Vancouver port, the Vancouver terminal?
I think maybe that was the one I'm thinking
because
about.
Because I know that
there's been local stuff too that's been pushed against it.
On the West Coast, there's a lot. So where we are in Portland, and you go all the way up to Canada, this is huge because the Alberta tar sands oil is coming from Alberta, Canada. And that is north of us here, right above Oregon and Washington. We have groups that are fighting, like Backbone Campaign is one of them. And I know that Bill Moyer is somebody that has been very proliferate in taking action and speaking out and trying to inform the public get groups together, activists informed about what's going on and how to address these companies that continue just to keep doing business as usual. They keep just saying, we're gonna be safe. We're going to pay attention, and you should trust us.
See, and I hadn't even heard of Enbridge, the actual name Enbridge or the company, before you brought it up.
I actually recognized the name from...
I just looked it up, actually, and it's been around since 49, so it's like 70 years older.
Which is actually extremely young in many ways.
And then I was also looking up what some of the biggest companies were, and it's not even in the top 10.
No, it's not. So what they're not like the big company like Shell or BP.
Yeah, they're like a little baby company.
They kind of do with the transport, so they're a whole different part of the infrastructure.
Okay.
They're not the big name that you see. That's why it's not the name on the gas pump. But
it's not Phillips. It's not like Exxon. It's not like BP. Yeah.
Right, right. It's not one of those. But they work with those companies. They contract with them. They're all friends. They're in the same industry, like they should, because they're in the same industry. Yeah. They should work together. These companies you've listed own the properties and the oil, and they own the rigs that are pumping it out. And they may have some level of pipelines or facilities, but then there are other companies like Enbridge that have a big bulk of the transportation infrastructure for major oil companies. And so Enbridge works in transporting the oil, not in owning the oil or the gas. They work in transportation. That's what makes them the big one. And I recognize their name from all the way back in 2016 protests when we were talking about Standing Rock all the way across the nation. We had people checking in on social media from their living rooms, checking in as if they were in Standing Rock in an effort with solidarity with those water protectors and the indigenous people trying to preserve life for everybody in this country. Because these waterways are interconnected. These waterways give life.
Yeah.
These waterways feed our plants,
water,
our birds,
life,
our animals. Those animals affect everything around us. So we may live in a city where we're not used to the moose walking through, or the raccoon might be normal. You know, wolves and coyotes, depending on where you live, it could be a nuisance. But that's really kind of our limit. We forget that we are part of it, I think. And that what we do to the environment affects all of it. So if we take out certain species, which unfortunately, based on some scientific data coming out in the recent years, we've been contributing
done.
To. Right, we're in a mass extinction event. It's an official thing. We're in an official mass extinction event. And the water is going to be the number one thing that is going to make life or death. Water is a unique property of our planet.
Water is life.
Water is life as far as we know it, because we're carbon-based and we require water. Our bodies are over 70% water. Our planet is over 70% water.
Interesting fact.
And we can't find water everywhere else. That's what we're looking for. And when we go to Mars, we're looking for water.
Interesting fact there, actually. The human body is 76% water, so is Earth.
76. See, I knew it was 70
both,
something.
Both of them are. So think about that one.
They're, I do. Both. I think that I've always known that there's like a, it's
there's
almost
a
identical.
Connection.
Right.
There's a connection.
It's almost like the Earth is a macro cell. We're like a mini example
yes.
of this. So how we treat the Earth when we say, hey, we don't care what we're putting in our waterways. We don't care how we damage things. We don't care if we kill off the diversity and variety that makes this organism function. We're literally hurting ourselves.
We're basically saying we don't care about ourselves.
We don't care about ourselves. And we don't care about our future either, because we only care about fantasy, it seems like. These companies are saying, you can trust us. We won't have an explosion. We won't have a spill. And what happened? We're 8 months into 2018, and there's two explosions by this one company off these pipelines in this one area on the eastern half of the U.S. We've got Kentucky and Ohio. And that's not all of it. We've had people trying to protest against these companies for decades. And in the last half decade, it's
picked
gotten
up.
a hotter topic. Yes,
yeah.
Taken off. We've got millions of gallons of oil that spill every year.
The one that scares me is there's actually a very vast number of oil rigs that had been like capped during the early 1900s down in Southern California. And a lot of them are just sitting there still exposed, and all the metals rusting away due to its exposure to the ocean water, and some of them have started to leak. And this stuff's not really being broadcast wide stream.
That's a very good point. That's part of what we would consider infrastructure. It has to do with maintenance of our systems. And if our system is still using this type of fuel resource, then before we even consider creating any new lines, any new pipes, it shouldn't matter if it economically harms the company and they don't get to make as much money and they don't get to pump as much fuel for 6 months while they are repairing a one of their lines. They shouldn't have, in my personal opinion, they shouldn't have the right to simply build a new pipeline to say, oh, well, it's going to increase the flow of this fuel source so that, well, this has been turned on. After this is built, then we'll go and shut off this old pipeline to repair it, but we're only repairing it to turn it back on so that we can have that increased volume capacity. And I think that's wrong. I think if the cost of business is doing business, if you have to repair your goods for your business to move forward, to go into business the next day, then you have to repair it. So, I mean, if this is a mechanic shop and he's only got one of those vehicle dollies, right, so he can get under the vehicle, work on the transmission, and that dolly breaks, he doesn't get to keep moving forward. He has to close down shop, and he's got to repair that dolly. And then he can open for business. And when he's open for business, people will say, you repaired that? That's great. Now I know it definitely works, because I wasn't sure before, and I didn't want my vehicle to get stuck on your dolly, you know, when it was going to be a two-hour repair, and I wouldn't get it for 3 days. But now that you've repaired it, automotive dude, I'm going to go to your shop because you've got up-to-date equipment. You care about how your job is going to affect other people that are relying on you. And these companies are not taking that stance. They are not caring about how they are affecting other people.
See, me personally, I'm a bit of a tree hugger. I honestly think that oil, gas, and all that is one of the worst fuel sources possible. I mean, I skateboard everywhere. I blow out a pair of tennis shoes or boots every like 3 to 4 months because of it. But I just can't even pull myself to get a license. I've known many people in my generation that are the same way. They don't want to get a license. They don't want to do, they'd rather ride a bike. They'd rather skateboard. They'd rather be without an actual vehicle, gas powered.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a growing movement, honestly, because people are, people are realizing the compound impact.
Yeah.
So when people say, look, I'm only one out of a million, this generation, it seems like, has got the growing concept that says, I am one in a million, but if the person next to me makes two in a million, and then his friend makes three in a million, and her friend makes four in a million, and all these pieces together add up to a huge force.
And they
recognize the value of their individual portion.
And then in those minds of those that actually care, there's also the ones that are noticing the people that don't care.
But
and then in the back of their head, they're like, oh, well, I'm making up for them too.
Right. So then that exact same statement can be twisted in the reverse, where people say, well, I'm only one in a million. I'm only one person.
Yeah.
I'm only one in a thousand or whatever. But we do have amazing activists and groups that have been working for all sorts of reasons, for decades, for a long time. So I don't want to denigrate the people that have spent their lifetimes, that are those older generations that have brought this. I mean, everybody knows about the hippie movement, you know, Flower Power, Summer of 69 is a great reference point for people to really start thinking about the environment. And one of those groups that was founded back, I believe it was in the 70s, was Greenpeace.
Yeah.
And I want to mention that there was a report published by Greenpeace that found that between 2002 and 2018, Enbridge averaged a rate of one hazardous liquid pipeline accident every 20 days. Or that would be for a total of 300 spills and 2.8 million gallons released into the environment. And 30 of those incidents reportedly contaminated water resources. 17 of them reported to contaminate groundwater, which is that right up at the top of the soil that affects us directly. That's the stuff we're going to slosh through. Your pets might drink.
See, this reminds me of another documentary I watched about like a year or so ago on Netflix. I can't even find it anymore. It's called Toxic Homefront. It was actually exploring how there was a small community somewhere in the Midwest that, so after it was basically nuclear waste, but still, it's runoff that we're focusing on here on this part. So there, after World War II, there was so much nuclear waste dumped by, like, the military and the U.S. government in just random spots throughout the country. And there was this small town over in Midwest somewhere, and they ended up having, like, a fire at the dump. And it resulted in a whole bunch of toxic chemicals being released up into the atmosphere and stuff, and radioactive particles and stuff like that. And so when they went to put out the fire, it ended up leaching into the waterway that was not too far away from it.
Right,
as well.
When it gets into the water table is what your reservoirs pull from. So yeah. The water table is what your cities and all of that, it's underneath the soil. And that's what we're tapping. That's what we're drinking. That's what we're cooking with, is the stuff that goes in the water table. That's what your pets are drinking. That's what you put on your lawn. That's what goes into the orchards that feeds the fruit or your home garden. That's why what goes into the groundwater and the soil matters. If it goes in the soil but not directly the river, it will end up in the water and it will end up in the river. Because what goes in the soil, eventually it passes through. We have an ecosystem, and that means that everything works together. That it matters what happens to our environment, whether it's a big oil spill or a giant fire. And before we move on, I just want to make sure people know some of the major issues that Enbridge has been in. I mentioned some of the key turning activists. There were the four key turners in Michigan. There was the Seattle activist that took on a couple of pipelines. They turned off two valves in 2016 near Bemidji.
Yeah, see, when you first said valve turner, I wasn't sure what you were talking about.
What it means is they're turning off the valve.
I thought it was maybe like a millennial getting creative and naming their baby something new.
A valve,
you know,
turner.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe catchy, I don't know, electropunk.
I don't know. I wasn't sure.
Maybe,
you know.
I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, maybe. I'd never heard the term valve turner.
Valve turner. It's become a popular thing. I know of it because of the 2016 issue.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing Ken Ward, and that's why I remember his name. I had the privilege to actually speak to him here in the KBOO studio.
Ooh.
Yeah, he was here because of what's going on with Pembina out of Portland and the Coos Bay LNG export terminal. 350.org has been one of the groups keeping an eye on that, like the Black Backbone Campaign is as well. Greenpeace is, of course, a global organization keeping an eye on all these things. And if it wasn't for people like this, we wouldn't be really knowing how vast these problems are. One of the big things that I wanted to leave people with, to let people know how bad Enbridge has affected people, was that I wanted to read off a little bit from a Quartz article that was made August 1st by Zoe Schlanger. And she discusses a lot about this. So go ahead and look up this article, and she'll tell you a bit about this explosion in Kentucky. But she also mentions that how Enbridge moves the liquid fuel, and it's behind the 2010 catastrophic Kalamazoo River spill. This was when their Enbridge pipeline burst. It spilled about 1 million gallons of the really thick, sticky Alberta tar sands crude oil into the ecosystem near the Kalamazoo, Michigan River. And this tar sands oil, this is really bad stuff. This is part of where people fighting against the Dakota Access Pipeline, the movement known as No DAPL, and people fighting against the Keystone XL, that they're worried about this Alberta tar sands oil because it's really bad. This article mentions that tar sands crude oil is nothing like its conventional crude oil counterpart. It is thicker and heavier and must be diluted with a cocktail of chemicals that often include benzene and other carcinogens in order to flow through pipelines. That spill took years and more than $1 billion to clean up, making it the largest and most expensive inland oil spill in U.S. history. So, I mean, we can already name off four or five different things. You'd mentioned Deepwater Horizon. I remember the Exxon Valdez ship in the pristine Arctic. We've been discussing or protesting against.
Yeah, there's the BP there
this.
In the Gulf of Mexico. There was all kinds of weird ones that just kind of followed each other after each other. You know,
in 2012, another Enbridge line spilled more than 50,000 gallons of crude oil in Wisconsin. And that required 17,000 tons of contaminated soil to be removed. That same year, the Enbridge line spilled more than 58,000 gallons in Alberta, Canada. They've really been affecting large amounts of land and large amounts of property in ways
and
that...
See, the amount they're moving, the amount they're pulling out of the ground and whatnot, and literally, that's a drop in the bucket to them, except for the big ones like in the Gulf and whatnot that are just constantly leaching out more and more and more and hitting millions of gallons. These little guys, like the 58, to them, that's nothing.
To them, that's nothing. To them, that is nothing. They are not.
To the people, that's nature. That's so many gallons of this nasty crud. Crude oil just smothering Mother Nature.
Yeah. It's choking it up. It's changing the genetic structure. I mean, it's toxic. This stuff, some of it can really, really do nasty stuff all the way down to the cellular level. I mean, it really, really is bad. I mean, this is the stuff that causes birth defects. I mean, that when it gets in the waterways and you have communities, Native American communities have been fighting this for ever, basically, ever since they have been essentially colonized. They have been fighting to keep the land clean, to keep pollution and harm from the environment, to keep the other members that want to create societies in this same geography, to keep them from destroying the waterways, from destroying the forest, from cutting down the forests and blowing things up, or setting fire to the forests and burning just everything that they are using as a natural resource without replacing it. Because that's been a big issue. We cause harm, we cause damage. And then when these rarely make it through litigation or to court, on those rare instances, the payouts for them get cut down. They get haggled over until they're reduced to a fraction of what's going to be needed, so that it only has to clean up a small, specific element of the greater picture that was affected. And that, to me, is a big tragedy.
Yeah.
And we're unwilling to take responsibility. And I think that's a cost to business that I personally don't care if a big company has to go out of business because they went bankrupt paying to fix the environment, paying to get people their homes back that got blown up, paying, people their insurance payouts for being harmed because they have been drinking contaminated water from these pipeline spills that were not properly cleaned up.
There are many reparations needed here.
There are a lot of types of reparations. And to be honest, many of these communities, the reason why we haven't heard about them for a long time was because they were marginalized communities. They are indigenous communities of Native and First Peoples. They are African American and Black communities. They are Hispanic and Asian American communities. It is not often the, quote, white person's community.
And see, we haven't even really explored.
And that was part of No Dapple. That was part of the No Dapple protest issue, was that pipelines.
No Dapple? What's No Dapple? You keep dropping that on me.
No Dapple's the Dakota Access Pipeline, DAPL.
Dakota Access Pipeline. Okay,
yeah. Isn't that clever?
People like acronyms too much in this day and age.
I thought that was a pretty good one. It's definitely stuck over a few years because I remember.
And we haven't even really talked about all the stuff up in northern Alaska that the Inuits and stuff like that they're dealing with. And
there's a lot going on in Canada because of the Alberta tar sands. Oil is a big hot topic right now, and everything also going as far as drilling in the Arctic, huge. And we could definitely back to this topic multiple times.
There's we could do an entire hour, 2 hours on this topic. And
I mean, just talking about one company, we could fill another hour. I mean, we've only been speaking for 29 minutes right now. So,
very passionate on the subject.
Which means you probably have another topic that you'd like to share.
Yes, I would.
Yay.
It's our potpourri.
Our potpourri.
Yes. First real good one that I've been able to present. So,
I'm going to eat this apple while you explain everything.
Oh, my goodness. You're just going to sit there and munch and annoy my. Yeah, no.
But you
no.
said pot. I've got the munchies now.
Okay, step away from the mic with the apple. So this one is the MORE Act. It's a federal one. It's calling for sweeping changes in federal cannabis law. Pretty much it's was introduced, it was back, this was actually a couple weeks ago or a week and a half ago now. So Gerald Nadler of New York and Kamala Harris of California introduced this bill, and it's the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act. The bill would decriminalize marijuana at the federal level by removing it from the Controlled Substance Act. About time, in my opinion. The MORE Act would also require federal courts to expunge previous marijuana-related convictions, allowing prior offenders to request expungement of their criminal records and, if needed, request resentencing hearings. And I'm reading this off of an article for Leafly called The MORE Act Calls for Sweeping Changes in Federal Cannabis Law. So, essentially, like, this would repair the damages done on the war on drugs and what I foresee, or what I see personally, as always being something that was never really needing to be criminalized like it was, cannabis. Yeah, that is one of the most asinine things, in my opinion, is for cannabis to be scheduled on, what is it, Schedule 1 narcotic, the highest on the list.
It's up there with opioids and stuff. It's actually it's up there with crack. Higher than cocaine.
It's up there with crack or whatever. It's up there with LSD or what. It's up there with some really bad drugs.
Really bad stuff, and it's up there.
And it's got therapeutic purposes.
For me personally, I've always been surprised. I went through the DARE program at school in the 90s because that was a thing on the West Coast, D-A-R-E.
DARE to tell the truth. What was it?
I think it was called, it was an acronym, of course, another acronym.
Yeah.
D-A-R-E acronym. Stood for Drug Abuse Resistance. And I honestly don't remember E at the moment. Maybe expectation or something, but drug abuse resistance something. Maybe education. And it was the only thing. I actually have this really weird clear memory from this one day where we have this police officer. You come into the classrooms, real friendly officer, be very nice. I want to say I was maybe in the third or fifth grade, in that range. And so this is the early 90s. And I, you know, was sitting there with my group. And we were handed out this piece of paper with all the pictures. And they kind of made it like a kid's game. And it was like, find the object that does not belong. And I was the only kid in the entire class that got it wrong because I missed one of the drugs. And the only drug I missed was the one that looked like a plant. It was a leaf. And it didn't make sense to me. And, you know, the officer was really nice about it. Didn't make a big deal. I just pointed it out and said, oh, it's this one right here. You know, now you know, is, you know, just teaching a kid. But for me as a kid, it didn't click. I didn't get it. I was like, but this one, it grows in the dirt. And like, if nobody does anything to this plant, it will still have these properties. You don't have to do anything to these properties. You don't have to give it special juice or feed it sweet potato, you know, water or anything funny. You don't have to add nutrients or chemicals or play with the soil like many people like to do, which is known in its culture. People love to play with the plant, but you don't have to. You could just get the seed and you put it in the soil, and just like your tomatoes. You add a little water and it just grows. That's it. Plant, nothing but water, like a tomato plant, which it's often
honestly,
common
that's
euphemism.
That's the most beautiful way, in my opinion, to do so. Is just let it do its thing.
Right, and it
comes
up with
a little bit of water
flavor.
At times. Pay attention to it. Put it in the ground and
so,
let it grow.
Something interesting about the MORE Act was that, see, I dug up a Forbes article, by the way, also from a few weeks ago around the same time. And it mentions that this MORE Act would impose a 5% federal tax on the sale of marijuana products.
Would that be added on top of,
Oh, yeah. See, some of that revenue would be directed toward a new opportunity trust fund aimed at supporting grant programs to provide job training and legal aid for people impacted by prohibition enforcement.
So
it would also have loans for small business marijuana business owned and controlled by socially and economically disadvantaged individuals and efforts to minimize barriers to licensing and employment in the legal industry. And it all sounds good, but when I read that, I actually see a lot of legalese that says, we're going to impose a tax to put it in this fund that has going to be so narrowly defined and these multiple
that only a few
branches,
people are going to be able to
that only
it.
A few people are going to be able to apply for. It's going to be cronyism and nepotism. It's going to be people that have the money to file the paperwork, the money to spend the time waiting for the paperwork to get reviewed and filed, because a real, true small businessman, a or business person, woman, that person doesn't have 2 months to wait for this place to come up with the paperwork and approve their business license. They need to turn in that stuff, and they need to know a time frame to get it back. They need to be able to estimate when they're going to get their product out.
I also feel like there might be somewhere in, like, the fine print or something, like a loophole or something stating that, like, once that money's not used for a certain duration, that taxed money gets used by the government.
There may
I feel like that's probably something in there as well.
It's probable. It's very common, honestly, for governments to create a loophole that diverts it to a general fund.
But, I mean, this is something that really does need to happen. This bill needs to happen, though, in my opinion.
In many ways, it does. And it's stuff like this that have gotten it thrown out before. This isn't the first type of bill that has been introduced in either the Senate or the Congress.
It's a conversation changer. I mean, it shifts the entire conversation. It changes the rhetoric that has been thrown towards cannabis for so many years. And it gives it a second chance, essentially, to...
I think you're being so generous. I don't think it changes.
I know. I'm hoping.
It doesn't change the rhetoric at all. The fact that there is rhetoric means that nothing has changed. What it does...
I've noticed here in Portland, I've traveled around this country quite often, and I've noticed different states, different attitudes from the officers about cannabis or somebody smoking in public. And I've noticed it here in Portland. And here in Portland, they, for even the last... 10 to 15 years. I remember they've always been fairly relaxed about it. They try not to arrest people for small quantities. But, I mean, other states, I've seen them just bust people for smoking a joint. And this stuff just... this... yeah.
The point is that what this is, it's a signifier that those in positions of authority... people that have affluence, which means they have, you know, influence, and they've got money. So affluence, these people are now willing to publicly recognize that cannabis, marijuana, pot, it's not going away.
I do not prefer the word marijuana. That is actually the name of a wild Mexican tobacco.
I actually have a problem with it as well because of the long, varied history. And we'll probably have to make some special episode one day that's just going to be all pot-themed, everything.
It's going to be a 420 episode.
Pot politics, the whole thing.
It's going to be a 420 episode.
Oh, gosh. We have to wait a whole year for that? You're mean. We'll do it sooner.
Maybe.
But we don't know when. There's just so much going on out there because when you talk about the history of legalization, if you look in the federal codes, the word marijuana is spelt with an H and not the J that many of us are familiar seeing the word. So they, let me finish here. So when they are making all these different laws in different states and they keep changing the word a little bit, what I find interesting is that if they want to make marijuana legal, what are we doing about marijuana that has been illegal since the 1930s? Because marijuana with an H is...
I personally want to try some of this wild Mexican tobacco. Because I know it isn't cannabis. I know it's not the same plant.
It is. The word cannabis means cannabis. The problem is that...
Let me
finish. Marijuana is a racial slur. It is against... the laborers and the community workers. It was against the jazz loving African American people that, you know, those guys in society, you know, 100 years ago were freaking out about because they were racist. It was
the
inappropriate
sounding name of
marijuana. Yeah. And they, you know, that's where that whole pot craziness comes from. That's where people's
Reaper
misinformation
madness.
Is still there because some people don't respond to some of the cannabinoid profiles the same that others do. The magic of the plant is that it naturally functions with the body's own endocannabinoid receptors. The body has natural receptors that have always been there. You are born with them, and they are programmed for this exact molecule profile. The type of molecules, the cannabinoids coming out of cannabis, marijuana plants, our body wants them. They need them, but they need different kinds. And there's a huge host of them. And we have not been allowed in this country to look into that for almost an entire century. We've been restricted, prohibited, and the few studies that have been come out, they've only been authorized if they were going to be run through NIDA, which means that they are, oh gosh, what is it, the NIHDA, NIDA,
another acronym.
It's another acronym, and it's, what it is, it's a federal, what's the word, not a group, not it's not a company, it's an organization,
Oversight
a branch.
Committee, or...
It's a big branch. It's
some bureaucratic name that they gave themselves because they want to feel important. I don't know.
They do research. Well, that's I'm getting off the topic. The point is that there's this one institution and they kind of have the oversight in a sense to say, look, we're only going to allow the studies with the plant coming out of the one approved place that the federal government grows it. We'll send you a sample if we approve your study, and we're only going to approve your study if your study is trying to find harmful effects of the marijuana
cannabis
plant.
The negative.
They will not approve studies that aim to find a positive benefit that is on record for people to go and research on the internet. There really is way too much for me to get into right now, which is kind of where...
Oh, this is an entire rabbit hole. That's what I mean. This is a subject that we could really dedicate an entire episode
but
to easily.
Hey, if the first time that somebody is willing to really understand what's going on is because Congress has finally put out this bill that says, hey, look, your neighbor's, you know, record from having that joint at a concert 20 years ago, we're willing to look into that and expunge it now. And if you want to make, you know, cannabis tinctures at home as a small business, that's possible. You might be able to apply for this loan under the MORE Act. That's what might make people notice this now. They would realize the possibilities and how that could affect them, their family, their neighbors. I think a lot of people don't even realize all the people that they know that consume or have utilized cannabis for more than recreation, or that people have found real benefit outside of recreation while recreating, while having fun. Like, they're aiming to get stoned because they want to relax. They want to not be stressed out about something. But they actually maybe realize that my headache went away, my appetite came back, which I have a hard time with when I'm stressed, or there's just a variety of symptoms like that you can read off online, firsthand accounts from people. That's what's getting this movement recognized.
Honestly, in my opinion, I mean, one of the most widely used for stress relief is alcohol.
Which is scientifically proven to actually make it worse.
Yes, and one of the things that's been constantly used. And, you know, I myself, when I'm trying to relax, I would rather just roll a joint and smoke. That's where I'm at. I wouldn't rather grab a beer or go party or a bunch of friends. I'm not that kind of a person. I'd rather just smoke a joint.
I can't remember where that quote is from. There's some old quote from somewhere about pot that says, like, the most dangerous thing about pot is getting caught with it. The most dangerous thing about being a cannabis consumer or a stoner or, you know, that the person that's only smoked the one joint in their life is the risk that you're going to get caught by law enforcement. The only real danger is that your life is going to be ruined, that you're going to have your home, your children, your pets, your family taken away from you or abandon you, reject you because they don't like that you're smoking this plant. And the irony is that I've actually argued with some family members in my history about this when I was smoking, you know, tobacco cigarettes and disliking it. And yet they understood and were okay with that. It was accepted. And that bothered me because that does a lot of harm to my body. That will cause me to stress out if I don't get that nicotine and other chemicals that come in the cigarette. But because that's a biochemical addiction problem. However, the cannabis doesn't do that. And there are scientific studies that have been done around the globe. A lot of research has come out of Israel, but they are not the only country. Canada's done a little bit of research. It's also something that the listeners should go and look up online. But that research is showing that there really is a positive benefit to smoking, far outweighing any level of harm. There is still a basic level of harm because when you're smoking, you're smoking. So anything you smoke is going to have that kind of, you're going to put stuff in your lungs. You're going to be, you're putting smoke in your body.
Myself have always been really in the mindset of that the U.S. government is very draconian about any kind of exploration of or expansion of the human spirit or the mind or whatnot. Because, I mean, there are serious benefits from microdosing with mushrooms that have been shown to help with stress and PTSD and, you know, CBD from cannabis helps with seizures and pain relief. And there's
somebody just legalized psilocybin, the magic mushrooms.
Denver? I think that was Denver.
I think that was in Colorado.
Yeah, that was Colorado.
Which is also legalized in cannabis.
Oh, yeah.
And they have been leading the way even more so, I would say, than Oregon. I think Colorado has been the champion leading state.
Oh, yeah.
In implementing programs of reform. They've had programs where they handed out 1 gram of pot to people who would pick up trash. I remember seeing that was somewhere, maybe it was Boulder, somewhere in Colorado. They had a program that said, hey, if you do some community service and you volunteer to beautify the roadways and make the community nice, turn in your bag of trash, show us that you're old enough, legal, and we'll give you a small thank you donation gift. And I thought little stuff like that actually brought people out in the community. They actually had people showing up to turn in trash that they had picked up off the roadside and from parks just for that little bit of bud.
Okay, so how about we use this as like a way to transition since we're talking about tree.
Oh, you want to talk about trees?
Well, we're talking about trees. I mean, it's another nickname for buds, for cannabis.
So you think this
pot.
Is a good opportunity to talk about a different kind of tree?
Yeah, so another one, and this subject's kind of like close to heart to me because I have family that's trying to get property down in this area, is the Milepost 97 fire down in Southern Oregon, just north of like Azalea, Glendale, over by Grants Pass, or just south of Grants Pass. I guess it started, I want to say that was Wednesday the 24th or so, and it's been going since then, and it's been actually increasing in size. You know, this is one of the first fires that has really caught major attention here. And
so it's been going for almost like over a week
yeah,
and a half.
It's been going for a week and a half, you know. And I got family that's trying to get property down there, and they're kind of freaking out because their property they're looking at down there in like
it's really close, isn't it? And that's got to be scary if you're anywhere within like 30, 50 miles.
I think they're within like 6 or 7 miles south where they're looking for property, and this fire is going pretty heavily. And I was just actually looking at an update of it, and within the time that we've been sitting here and talking and over the course of the day, apparently they've gotten the 20% more containment of the fire. So it's actually at a 45% containment.
So they're making good improvement then.
Yeah, so they almost have it half contained. I think the weather today is probably helping too because it was kind of nasty, you know. One of the first actual nasty days was August. Yeah. So, yeah, they're currently at like 13,000 acres. They're 45% contained. There's been reports out of it from Oregon Live and everywhere else. And apparently it started because of an illegal campfire that Wednesday night, the 24th, I believe that was. Yeah.
Oh, man. The campfires, you have to remember when you go camping that the embers.
Oh, yeah.
That your embers. So people forget about that. They think, oh, it's not flaming up anymore. It won't catch. Well, no, if you can't put your hand all the way in the middle of where that fire was and count to 5 1,000s, you cannot leave that campsite. And that's what I was taught back in my time as campfire boys and girls, is that you've got to take care of that or you won't have forest left.
I was always taught just continue to unload your bladder on the fire before you leave. That's where I was told.
That is a valid liquid. I was definitely
that's
told that that was
you.
A valid liquid.
That's
if
I,
it
that's
puts
my
out
uncle.
The fire,
Sorry.
It puts out the fire. And, you know, as long as it's not going to burn down the trees, because the only trees you want to burn, you
but
know,
yeah, this is
those.
Actually ending up like, so I guess Azalea, the city that's south of the fire right now, and Glendale. So I guess there was like somewhere near 1,000 people that or something like that that showed up at Glendale's high school and like packed their gymnasium, and they were getting prepped for an evacuation. Then they actually like were either on the verge of evacuation or actually evacuated the city. I hadn't really followed that story exactly too much, but You know, and now that it's at 45% contained, they're actually reducing the threat level down a little bit, and they're probably allowing people to come back or not evicting or not evacuating at this point, so that because the fire is not hitting them as hard. But I mean, it's really rocky terrain. It's really, really forested. It's dry, much like, you know, Eastern Oregon's the desert. You got Southern Oregon. It's really hot. It's really dry. A lot of these trees are old growth, and I mean, there probably hasn't been a whole lot of maintenance done in some of these forests because of how thick the thicket is, you know. And so these trees have just been sitting there allowing to build up. It's a real danger once you're out there and you're camping and whatnot and you don't pay attention to this stuff. And this is the kind of result of what happens.
Wow. I was looking up real-time wildfires map. While you were talking, I was curious because...
How many do we got going in Oregon right now?
Well, it's a visual map, and so they've got these little dots on here, and the one that you're talking about looks like it's the only one in this state, but it's got a healthy-sized bubble on it.
Okay, so it's a big one, but it's the only one in the state.
Right, and the reason it's a large-sized bubble, honestly, it's they've got a bubble size by acres, and then they also do a color shading. So the color shading will tell you how contained it is. And this one, it's got around that 60%. It's almost coloration. So
yeah, they're saying 45%.
So they're probably just making progress left and right. But there is actually one that's a little smaller, and that looks about half the size. It's the top of the California border.
Is that the...
And it has no containment. This is a dark, dark red. It's got to be below 20% containment, but
it doesn't
look
very
big. Is that
like the Redding or Weed, California area? Or
It's right near the border. It's at the northeastern top corner.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
The fires are going, man. And this is the season.
They're everywhere.
We're going into it, and this is the time you have to be really, really careful.
You've got a couple of them all the way down in Arizona, the New Mexico,
Nevada. And see, that's
Nevada.
Not surprising at all, because that's even drier.
It's
that's
a dry desert area. And these are, these are the dark red bubbles. These are the ones that are not contained too much. If you remember what we were talking about earlier, pipelines, this is an area like you've got infrastructure passing through. You've got highways, you've got gas pipelines, and oil pipelines.
So these pipelines could get engulfed by flames and burst that way,
just in
too.
The moment,
oh,
this
yeah.
is immediately making me wish that I could find a map that would show me the wildfires and the pipelines to overlay to see how close
they are overlapping
would be.
Currently
wow.
And what might be a future disaster that nobody's really kind of
right.
paying attention to.
Yeah, we've got a couple of these in, Montana. There's some fires, a couple in Idaho. There's fires, little ones all across the U.S., but there's a lot out here on the west side. Nothing as big as those we had. Was that the Eagle Creek fire?
Yeah,
it was one
the
of the
Eagle
really
Creek
bad.
Fire. I was actually talking to another friend of mine, journalist friend Ryan Haas from OPB, and he was talking about how it came pretty close to his house when the Eagle Creek fire ended up getting such a huge engulfed area because of how extensive it got. It resulted, ended up getting right on the outskirts of Troutdale, if I remember.
Yeah, it did. It got really close. I mean, the smoke took over the whole city for...
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was weeks, basically.
I left when it occurred for New York because my brother invited me out there, and I spent like a week out there.
So you got to go travel to visit family.
And yeah, and by the time I got back, they had most of it contained as far as I had known. But like when I was leaving, I have pictures still of just nothing but Portland covered in thick, thick smoke.
Wow. Well, you know what? Well, you mentioning flying just makes me want to throw in a real quick little mention about how the Oregon Real ID Act, just to remember that Oregon is one of the few states, I think it's like one of five states, that is, it's not compliant yet, but they have an extension. So we have an extension through Oregon of
I usually try and get an annual trip into my brother's place in New York.
That requires you to take a domestic flight all the way across the nation. And you won't be able to do that with an Oregon ID until you can buy the new updated version. I read somewhere, I want to say like early 2020, Oregon says you might be able to get your new ID because...
And these federal regulations are October...
The extension only goes to October of 2019. Now,
October 2020.
No, you will be allowed they will be accepted in places such as commercial flights. So you can't, you already can't get onto military bases, and you already can't get into nuclear facility sites without updated Real ID. That's something. Real ID is a standards that were set up by the federal government. These standards were created and implemented. They were created by the suggestion of the committee that looked into the 9/11 attacks, and that
I was reading up
and
about
they
this.
Said that those hijackers had all obtained state IDs, and so they for those people determined that it would be smart to make the average every citizen of this nation provide excessive paperwork and multiple proofs of residence in order to get a state ID or driver's license in their own home state, which to me, it seems a little silly. It just makes it the burden on the average citizen rather than putting the burden on the agencies that gave IDs to people that were not, that had no business getting one in the first place. These people that the committee had found had hijacked were not citizens of the U.S., then that burden and that failure fell with a governmental agency. But yet, rather than making the agency have better protocols, they're actually requiring us citizens to make sure on our end we have an ID. So in Oregon, the ID lasts 2 years, and you're required to, it's often set up for your birthday is about the day. So I would like to suggest this scenario. If Oregon's web pages that I was reading a little bit about this earlier today, actually, which is where I'm pulling the information from rather than off the internet in my face. But Oregon was mentioning that you can get the new ID sometime in early 2020, okay, beginning of the year. Well, that's still 5 months away. What if my birthday is in November or December? It's at the end of the year. And so what if it's this month? What if my birthday is next week here in August? What if I need to get a brand new driver's license or ID right now?
Mm-hmm.
What if I have to get that this week? We don't have an ID that meets federal standards at this current time. The ID that I would be required to get this week is going to last me 2 years. But in 5 months, they're supposedly going to have a new upgraded version, or maybe as soon as 5 months. I don't know if it'll come out in January or maybe March, whenever Oregon will have these new IDs for us. But when they do, it's going to be early 2020. It's pretty standard.
So
that
you're
going
to have to present like a whole bunch of paperwork, birth certificate, Social Security, probably like a piece of mail,
you
have residence and all that.
Multiple pieces of mail, multiple pieces of proof of residence,
then,
birth
and
certificate.
Then she'll extra cash out of your pocket for this ID for what? What's on the new ID that's supposed to make it so it's more identifiable as certified or whatever?
If I was to have to get this now in Oregon, it's not compliant. It's going to last me 2 years, and I've spent the money for a 2-year driver's license. When Oregon does come out with a new ID, I'm not reading anywhere that it's saying they're going to give me a new ID where I can just say, here's my old one that I bought in August of 2019. And now it's January and you have a Real ID compliant state ID. I want to turn it in. I paid my money. How is that going to work? They're not discussing that. They're not talking about the people that have to get it now because I don't have a choice. To literally just buy a brand new ID? So, am I only going to pay the difference in ID cost? And honestly, why am I paying the amount that I do for that ID? I want the DMV. I want the state to tell me what the cost is to actually supplying me that ID. Like, what's the actual cost of making and printing and shipping this ID with these security features?
Yeah, I want to know what the security feature is.
I can't remember all offhand because I closed that webpage, but, like, it's elements of special marks, special...
Like a hologram.
Special holograms. I think the RFID chip or something like that where it can be scanned into systems and stuff like that. It's not just something that you show anymore.
Well, yeah, it's something that can be... ways around some of those like holograms and some of those weird... But the RFID chip's a little bit easier.
They're supposed to integrate with technology.
So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, for your basic person who's just, you know, regular ID, they won't need this, though. It's going to be for people who are flying constantly.
It doesn't matter if you're flying constantly or once every 5 years. If you want to take a flight to Hawaii, if you want to go to Seattle from Portland, if you want to go to Arizona to see the Grand Canyon from Portland, you have to have a real ID, compliant ID. Okay. And we don't have it in the state. You will not be able to go places. That means the border crossings, you can't go. As it is, can't go to Canada, can't go to Mexico.
So if the state's not in compliance with it, that's just...
That means that you're basically landlocked to your state and you can't do anything but drive. And if you go to a Border Patrol check, you don't have an ID that is compliant to a federal Border Patrol check or a port of entry.
So this is going to result in, like...
What if I want to take a ferry into Canada rather than drive over the border because that's my special experience that I would like to plan? I can't do that.
Well, and so
I already can't go without, you know,
I do know
getting
in some
upgraded.
Of the,
but
I do know in some of the southern states, and they try and deny this, but there are buffer zones that people have to go through, and actual border agents, and these are like miles away from the actual Mexican-U.S. border, and these people have to go through there and
border,
get checked.
The Border Patrol and Customs has authority within 100 miles
yeah.
of any border or port of entry. So 100 miles from a coast or 100 miles from the border is within their jurisdiction or purview, which means that, yes, if you're driving in from Canada or Mexico, it doesn't matter. You could be going into Montana, and you could randomly have a Border Patrol station, you know, 75 miles into Montana from Canada. And that's where the Border Patrol station is. It's not at the border always.
And so they're kind of relying on every state to set the regulations and get their own stuff going and meet
the
federal
They have
the
guidelines.
Standards,
the federals, the feds put the guidelines out. That's what you will find by going online.
So
the federal, the, like the website, they have it all listed
so
out.
This
if you just type in the Real ID Act, you will find what those requirements are that will answer that question. You will be able to see which states are not compliant. There's only a few of them that are not compliant but have the extension, and Oregon is one of them, and that extension, it goes, you know. However, the federal page will mention that we understand, you know, we understand that the states aren't on top of this. So if you're trying to take a domestic flight, airports and things like that, municipal airports, they'll accept your state ID up to a certain point, and that's October of 2020. But if you wanna go and visit a U.S. territory like Puerto Rico, I don't think that will apply. I'd have to check, but I think that's too far. That's practically international. It's not really a domestic flight, but it's not really an international flight either.
Do you know, because my brother from flies New York, Puerto Rico all the time, he didn't require a passport for that one. So
they don't take a passport. No. Okay.
So that
There's
one's
some
fine.
Weird rules with the U.S. territories,
that's,
and
yeah.
I'm not as well versed with the U.S. territories, because honestly,
the U.S.
we are not
Samoa
we're
Islands.
We're not taught that.
Those guys, you do need a passport. I guess they're far out enough.
I think part of that is because you have to go to international waters to get there. That might be the hitch.
Yeah,
is that the Gulf of Mexico is still within that 100 miles? Not even 100 miles, but it's like 10 miles of the coast is considered country's own waters. So it's within that certain amount of miles.
So
nautical miles.
You looked
by
at the website.
Way.
Did it show more? Did it kind of like break down which states were more in compliance and which ones weren't? Well, I mean, I was just trying to figure out if this is going to cause issues for like a bunch of states on the northern border, on the southern border. I mean, you say it's going to cause. I'm wondering how many other states are going to have to deal with this issue.
I would
well.
Say we don't really have a lot more time. We've already spent a little extra time covering this. I just wanted a quick mention of that because it's something that, or it's just another government thing that we have to worry about. It's another political issue.
It's bureaucratic and it's
that,
a headache.
That affects the citizenry.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for joining us. This has been Trippy.
KBOO Portland.